Good afternoon, everybody. It's now been quite a while since I've been able to come back here and continue with the six stages of discipleship. We've had our conference and we've had other vigils and for various reasons. It has not been possible to get back easily. But now here we are on this important section. Today is May 31st, 2021. And I think it's been more than 2 months or so since I've been able to return. And I apologize for that. But certain things have just not been possible for me, for, as I say, for various reasons. Now, we can continue here. We have dealt with, what have we? Disciples can therefore grasp their growth towards fusion as an ashram. So disciples can therefore grasp their growth towards fusion as an ashram, in process of physical exteriorization by the developments of their spiritual recognition of the inner group potency and their facility to contact the Master, both as individuals or in group formation. I think there is a sense in which the Master lays great emphasis upon the approach of the entire group towards him, and especially at the time of the full moon. Not so many within his groups could do this individually. And he did say, however, that some knew the methods of doing so. All right. One of the things which a master has to do is to teach his disciples to study and register truthfully their usual point of daily focus. Well, you know how it is. There's so much exaggeration, let us say, unfortunately. And this exaggeration makes for a situation in which the disciple does not truly understand the lower level, or let's just say the level of contact that he or she has achieved. So often there is conceit, if you will, and exaggeration. Now let's see here. I'm going to try to I almost forgot how to do this, how to outline these things. Teach his disciples to study and register, and really the word is truthfully, their usual point of daily focus. That that can be a problem. Because, you know, so many people are in a hurry. They are ambitious. They want to achieve suddenly and without the requisite effort what they eventually will achieve. So they exaggerate their point of contact, and they imagine that they are really in touch with the master when this is not the case. So this constitutes the usual introspective training. And when followed sanely and wisely, leads to the realization of the true persistent inner level of consciousness. This is not that sort of morbid introspection which the Tibetan often decries. He says, no, this is not what is needed, but this is the true introspective training. And notice his emphasis upon the words sanely and wisely. Roberto Assagioli always used to quote the Latin, the English of which is make haste slowly. So this is the kind of training that we are undergoing. If we simply have the sane and wise patience to undertake this training in the manner that the Tibetan actually suggests, it fosters also a recognition of the need to overcome limitation, frequently not the limitations usually registered, you know, the hidden limitations which the Tibetan advised his students of when he took them under his teaching. Frequently, their limitations were not what they expected. And the necessity for breaking the barriers imposed by the personality. Well, I'm sure we're all aware of certain limitations, but the surprising thing may be that they are not the limitations we imagine. The whole process might be summed up in the following words. The purpose of the ashram and the training, training which it gives is to enable the disciple to live truly on every plane which he has succeeded in opening up to his consciousness. I guess there's a difference here between opening a plane and actually being able to live truly upon that plane. The purpose of the ashram and the training which it gives is to enable the disciple to live truly on every plane which he has succeeded in opening up to his consciousness. And how is that done? Through an increasing point of tension, shall we not say? always being able to live at a higher and higher point of tension. Let's see if I can. Yeah. It's been so long since I've been here that I have to refresh myself with the methods. It is important to remember that no one is integrated into an ashram until he has pierced beyond the confines of the purely personal levels of awareness, which hold, you know, these purely personal levels hold the majority of human beings in thrall. Thraldom is imprisonment, isn't it? So when you say to someone, ah, you look enthralling, well, not necessarily a good thing. Until he is sensitive to the ray and quality of the master of the ashram, and until he is normally soul conscious. The achievement of this involves great responsibility, and it is the shouldering of this responsibility which brings about what I might call ashramic consciousness, a consciousness devoid of self-interest and always preoccupied with the essentials of spiritual living. This is such an important segment here. Let's make it a little bigger. And I'll repeat it. I feel like it's so important, it needs to be repeated. It is important to remember that no one is integrated into an ashram. It's not a question of just, you know, barging in an unrelated manner. Until he has, now here's the word, pierced beyond the confines of the purely personal levels of awareness. That may mean, yes, there are still some personal levels of awareness, of course, but they are not purely personal, such as enthrall so many, capture so many. Until he is sensitive to the ray and quality of the master of the ashram. After all, how else could he carry forward the master's behests unless there was at least some similarity of soul or monadic ray? Or a sharing of soul or monadic ray, which he shared with the master. And until he is normally soul conscious. Now that seems maybe an easy thing to achieve because we repeat it so often. Focus within the soul, achieve soul consciousness, achieve the awareness of the higher mental plane. No, it's not easy. And the reason for our lack of success in meditation is simply that it's not easy. Not at all. And eventually, by the time we reach the third initiation, We might say we are normally soul conscious. The achievement of this involves great responsibility. I guess we can see more, and when we speak or write or radiate, that speech, that writing, that radiation carries more power for good or for ill. One has to be so careful what one says to others so as not to discourage people, in fact, to encourage them, and at the same time, not to let pass errors which could be corrected and which eventually will need to be corrected. Now, the Tibetan is just a master at that. Shall we say, sometimes letting people down lightly when they have presumed certain things which just aren't the case. One of the most skillful presentations to a student, which the master gave, was to let him down lightly from a position in which that student had thought he had achieved the fourth initiation, and DK had to adjust his ideas to let him know he might achieve the second initiation in that life. Now, that would be a crest falling, wouldn't it? And especially if you had a lot of your personality force invested in the idea that you had achieved the fourth initiation, as this man, ISGL, apparently did. The result was he quit the Tibetans group, and I would say probably did not fulfill the possibilities which were offered to him, that is, to achieve the second initiation in that life. So, the path of discipleship may be filled with many such disappointments, shall we say, but those disappointments are mostly or coming from a lower ego investment, personality investment, and not from a preoccupation with the essentials of spiritual living and with the objectives of the ashram. The little self is still looming too large for that new kind of ashramic freedom to be achieved. Okay, going on then. The primary preoccupation of chelas at the beginning of their technical training is of a very varied nature. And the ashram life is usually merely an interesting background for daily experience and not the factor of importance, which it should be, and not the main interest in the foreground of consciousness. Of course, the problem there is that on the other side, it can become too preoccupying. But if I can put it this way, it's kind of a personal preoccupation with spiritual matters. So again, there's still a great deal of the person involved in the ashramic interest. And I suppose it depends on what the individual has achieved and what the next step may be. And the master has to be ever so attentive and perspicacious, if I can use that word, to see what is the next step in the training of his newly entering disciple. So he's saying, really, we don't take it seriously enough. The necessities of daily living, everyone has to deal with them, of course. The many and diverse family contacts, each with their particular karma and their tendency to evoke from us responses which may be good or not so good. The resentments against life and its impacts, as if one were treated unfairly, knowing that karma is just. A dislike of criticism and of being misunderstood. The many problems of character, presumably our own character, which evokes adverse reactions from those around us, the pressures of psychic unfoldment, an inevitable process, but probably confusing at first, and the pettiness of circumstance, how we have to just deal with 1,001 things which don't seem all that interesting, frequently loom so large that awareness of the ashram and its life is only an occasional inspiration instead of a fixed habit of thought. A fixed habit of thought. Well, we know at high points, such as the full moons or new moons or special festivals, inspiration can come, will come. But imagine that the ashram becomes a fixed habit of life. Attention to the ashram is approached from such a steady point of tension relative to the appropriate level that awareness of the ashram becomes a fixed habit of life. The ability to make comparisons to the detriment of others, particularly of one's own fellow disciples or of one's own circumstances, the fear to let go, and throw all one is and has into the life of the ashram. That grips many, does it not? We forget that to those who give all is given. Foreboding as to the future, and a host of mental thought forms, plus undue attention to the cyclic life of the physical body. And there are a number of these cycles, maybe some of them biorhythms and other prevalent cycles. Present the master with an appalling picture with which of the liabilities with which he is confronted. And that appalling picture, as heavy as it is, has to be minimal compared with the picture with which the Christ is presented as he contemplates maybe the next approximately 2,500 years with his physical appearance within humanity and his, what can we call it, assignment, accepted assignment to help monumentally with the redemption of humanity. Well, this is a picture from the master's point of view. So many different interactions, and the giving of too much attention to these interactions, so that a steady awareness or focus upon the ashram is veiled. I think if we are honest, we will recognize a number of these as veiling factors, a number of these tendencies as veiling factors. Which prevent real ashramic participation. Or at least it takes place more slowly than otherwise it would have to. The factor of the attitude of the master is one which disciples are very apt to forget, because they are so basically interested in in themselves and in their reactions and problems. So this is pointing to our basic selfishness. And it looks like, you know, something that we simply have to grow through. I guess maybe everyone starts this way. And the process of decentralization is not a rapid one, as it could be. At least it could be more rapid, and should be. Okay. So here DK is telling us quite a bit about the attitude of true disciples in the ashram, and I suppose he's giving us the opportunity to compare our own attitudes with those that are ideal, those that are desirable. Going on. It might here be noted that disciples in an ashram are primarily occupied with world affairs. As a group, they are pledged to world work. As individuals, they are learning so to work, to take their eyes off the little personal self and to think of the larger issues, in which really they play a tiny part, but that innate lower egotism is difficult to overcome. Even though it seems legitimate to be concerned about how one is doing in the training process. Would-be disciples, I sometimes wonder if we are anything but that, need to distinguish between the effect, magnetic and dynamic, ingoing and outgoing, of the group, and the conscious effort which the group may make under united desire and direction of the master to reach the minds of those directing world affairs and world happenings. The outer happenings are to a certain point predictable. They are precipitated. The precipitated effects of inner causes which lie deep in the subconsciousness of humanity. And I suppose we have to find ourselves to be part of the beneficent inner causes and not just that which drags humanity and its leaders back into a repetitive and long outworn lesser conditions. So hidden causes, which lie deep in the subconsciousness of humanity, these can be noted and up to a certain point are offset or stimulated by the group potency. This is one of the major tasks of the hierarchy. The when he says something like that, you know, we want to take note. The master's work in the light and in the realm of causes. Disciples are as yet necessarily involved in the world of effects and therefore of illusion. So the world of effects is, as here given, the world of illusion. to work dominantly with the focal points of spiritual energy upon the outer plane immediately involves two factors. So what I will do, I'll go back here and emphasize the world affairs, which should be our center of attention. So, group is making certain initiatives which are magnetic and dynamic. And also is responding to the master. To distinguish between these is important. And we can, under the master, reach the minds of those who are leading, who are conducting world affairs. Okay. So let's see. I think I'm going to have to. Sometimes it happens that I press the wrong button and I get something that's not really readable. Yeah, but now it is. So what if we want to work dominantly with the focal points of spiritual energy upon the outer plane? What if we really want to emulate the major task of hierarchy? Well, let's see, at least one of the major tasks of hierarchy. And to move our initiatives from the world of effects into the world of causes. What is required of us if we're going to do that? So to work dominantly with the focal points of spiritual energy upon the outer plane will involve certain things. All right, what? A deep and unerring. Why does he include that word, unerring? Because it is possible to pretend that one loves or to think that one loves, and yet to love amiss and to substitute desire for love. But this is real love, and it makes no mistake. A deep, unerring love which sees in the light. Love is truly the revealer. Such an amazingly simple and important statement. If we want to know, especially the deeper nature of our fellow human beings and of our nations and of humanity as a whole, it is love which will reveal what we would see. And then what else? The power to withdraw completely as individuals and as a group from the world of physical reactions, emotional biases, and to work on mental levels, therefore, to abstract ourselves from the emotional and etheric physical, but especially the dense physical levels of reaction. There, and to focus on mental levels. This is often learned under Mercury and in relation to the sign Scorpio, but not exclusively so. And what is the advantage? There, the disciple is focused in his lower mind, but consciously oriented towards the soul, and is becoming increasingly sensitive to the intuition and toward the vision and the plan, remember, conceived upon atmic levels, the plan, at least conceived by members of the hierarchy upon atmic levels, as well as towards the group soul and to the master, all in this order of response. So intuition, vision of the plan, group soul, and the master. Okay. Let's see if I can get a little something here. Yeah. So, mind, soul, intuition, group, soul, master, in this order. Okay. So let's find an appropriate color here. I think we can do that. Yeah, we can do that. And let's see if I can, I'll just pause here for a moment. So we're looking here, if we're to work dominantly with the focal points of spiritual energy upon the outer plane, here are the factors. Seeing in the light, seeing in the light, and withdrawing completely from physical reactions and emotional biases, and to focus on mental levels. Maybe not so easy to do. And let's see here. Whoop. Let's see if I can get this to be correct. So it turns out that there are actually three methods of working dominantly upon with focal points of spiritual energy upon the outer plane. So to see in the light, that is one, realizing that love is the true revealer. Then this withdrawal from physical and emotional biases and working on purely mental levels, oriented towards the soul, however, and in order of orientation, we have the mind, the soul, the intuition, the group soul, and the master. As he says, this is our order of response. And now, the third point. Next follows, he says, the power as a group to formulate the desired thought effect in such a manner that it will reach the mind or the soul of those you seek to contact. To project the thought form built in such a way that it will be of the type and quality needed to evoke response. This is part of speaking proportionately to your interlocutor, to the person with whom you are dealing, or the soul with whom you are dealing, and going on, so meet the need of those the disciple is seeking to help and strengthen. It's a bit of a magical process, is it not? The projected thought form will embody the light and love as well as the idea of the group in conformity with group vision. So to have good intentions is not enough, but to have the skill in action to actually reach the individual or the groups even that one is trying to contact, this is required. So if we want to work from inner points of causes into the outer world of effects, these three factors seeing in the light, yes. Withdrawing from the lower reactions and right formulation of the thought form to be projected and hopefully to do some good. These are the three factors which enable us to work successfully. Now, here DK asks a really significant question. For how many is this kind of work possible? Not many as yet. Disciples are usually more preoccupied with their desire to help than with the scientific technique of helping. So it is a science, and it has to be studied and the benevolent desire to be of assistance is not enough. They need to take the desire for granted and then forget about it. I would ask all disciples at this time to make it their major effort to see the vision clear, to recognize and know for what they are, those who are in high position, this factor of recognition, sometimes demanded by others when it is not warranted. But nevertheless, there are those always ahead and offering the helping hand. And so to recognize those who are in high position guiding humanity, that is, of course, the hierarchy, and whose responsibility it is to lead humanity out of slavery into freedom. This is what we falls upon us as a responsibility, and a worthy one, one that we cannot evade. So ask yourself, you know, we all want to help, don't we? But have we taken that high desire to help simply for granted and then studied carefully the methods of helping? He certainly does point out the fallibilities through which it seems we almost inevitably travel. We journey through these fallibilities until we overcome them. And it's so possible to become attached along the way and to lose one's freedom of expression by becoming enthralled by this phase or that phase. So we are to recognize the members of the hierarchy and their high goal, their high destiny, to lead humanity out of slavery into freedom. Look at that word, slavery. Because at the moment, so many of us, if not all the time, are enslaved by glamour and illusion, not to mention the chaos of Maya. So further, it tells us about our attitude to those who are trying to help us. Aid them with love, because they are where they are through their individual destiny and the guidance of their souls. Life must be seen truly and faced as it is, not realistically. Now, there's a special use of the word realistic. Doesn't really mean having to do with the real. It has to do with what appears. Not realistically from the world standpoint, but from the standpoint of the soul, whose vision is long and inclusive, and who sees life as it is. I think it must be very difficult for so many human beings to actually begin seeing things factually as they are. It is problematic so often, because we don't have the patience and we don't have the courage. And we are not able to, as it was telling us, pierce through those levels of illusion and delusion, glamour, chaos. But we will learn, and soul vision will become ours. Now, on the higher levels of the mental plane, when our consciousness is focused there, we can share in the long vision of the soul. And what we have long forgotten on our ordinary personal human levels is well known to us. Maybe a number of lives ahead. It's said the angel can see forward several lives and backward also, and has a much clearer idea of the whence, whither, and wherefore than the man will in his ordinary personal consciousness. And that's maybe why it's so important, you know, to gain this vision of the soul, so we can have the necessary patience to follow the correct trajectory into a more spiritual way of living. A little bit more, perhaps, you know, coming back to this is not the easiest thing, but okay. The acceptance of facts is one of the first duties of a disciple. Well, we are being challenged even now in society by statements which are fact-free. They are lies. They are misrepresentations. They are unhinged to the reality as the soul sees that reality. It's dangerous. And it's, well, commonplace. And millions upon millions are believing in fact-free theories, which can only mislead and destroy the good, which has been engineered already. So, the acceptance of facts is one of the first duties of the disciple. Can we think of anything that might come to our mind where we have been hesitant to accept that which is factual? So, in the task of aiding humanity, as a part of the master's group or ashram, the fact that there are men and women placed in positions of power to carry out the divine plan is one of the first to be faced. And of course, you know, without envy, without jealousy, with none of those strictly human personal reactions. This, he says, must be done uncritically, avoiding constant recognition of their limitations, you know, trying to tear them down somewhat in a competitive manner, with an understanding of their problem, with realization of the call of their souls to yours, and the pouring upon them of a constant stream of loving understanding. So we will always meet our superiors, and they actually do need our, they need our help. And we try not to look at their fallibilities, because of course they are human and they will have failings. We try instead to further the good that they can do for us and for others. He goes on. I mean, I'm thinking of Alice Bailey here, you know, and what may have been the response, the reaction to her leadership and to her direct contact with the Tibetan. It need not have been entirely wholesome. And among some disciples, there was competition and the desire to take her place, especially as she was weakening in the physical form. They are more advanced disciples than you are, little as this may be realized. They are, consciously or unconsciously, under the impression of the masters, maybe FDR was such an individual, maybe Churchill, for all his apparent fallibilities, was the same, or at least under their impression. There is little the average disciple can do for them in molding their thought or in shaping their decisions. I refer, of course, to the leaders of the forces of light upon the outer physical plane. And this is, shall we say, during the war, that great Armageddon-like war, which was so decisive in so many ways, even though we have not learned all the lessons from it. But here is something we can do. Disciples and aspirants can surround them with a guardian wall of light and love, even as we would-be disciples are being surrounded by a great guardian wall from hierarchy. And when we're involved with the preparation for the reappearance of the Christ, we are, as it says, marked out for protection. And they can refrain, we can refrain, from handicapping them with thoughts of criticism, which can swell the tide of criticism which the worldly-minded pour out upon them, because naturally, the people of whom he is speaking are not, strictly speaking, worldly-minded by any sense. They may be practical, but their idealism is very strong. I mean, when you think of what of how Churchill's oratory defended England and even Europe, many aspects of it, when you think about what FDR did for the common man, FDR had Virgo rising, which relates to the common worker. They both did some amazing things, much needed things. They were imperfect in many ways, but this is to be expected. And we as disciples or would-be disciples, with a relatively strong power of thought, must not emphasize the vulnerabilities of those we recognize as ahead of us on the path and able to do something of value for those who are up and coming. Now, here he talks about an important matter as to attempting to reach and influence the leaders of the forces of materialism. And at that time, it would have been Hitler, Mussolini, Tojo, workers on that side. I would ask you to refrain, he says. It can more easily be done because the personality of the disciple will provide an open door of approach. Obviously, we don't want to approach with the personality and the dangers involved. but they are far stronger than the average disciple. And you know, the Tibetan does not tend to exaggerate. And the task would therefore be one of extreme danger. So here again, we have to go with his tendency to speak the truth at all times. And even now, there are those who work along this line, maybe not with the same obsessive power that took place during the Second World War, but still certain leaders aided and abetted by the negative forces. We have to be cautious. He asks us to refrain from attempting to reach them and influence them. We might simply hurt ourselves and hurt the projects for which we are responsible. Let's see. Well, I'm not sure how much I've really done yet, but this is about the ashrams. And I think that for the moment, I will say that, you know, given my stamina, if you can call it that, I'll call it a day on this particular program. So at least I've been able to re-begin this work. So many obstacles, you know, but one simply has to learn to keep on keeping on. So whether this begins later today in May or perhaps June, which will be tomorrow, we will see. We still have maybe another 70 or so pages to go in this section. So it is not a short section. It already exists in terms of commentary on Makara, written commentary. But I wanted to take it up again in the video format, as that sometimes is useful for all of us. So we'll let this go now. And all of us on the communications team are wishing you lots of love, deep studies, and the ability to apply what you learn in meditation. And as much service of the kind appropriate to you as you can originate, you can execute. So, see you soon, and bye-bye for now.